From WBUR Boston, I'm Bob Oakes, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. During the Cold War, foreign policy seemed so much simpler. Great argument in political science departments around America was between realists and idealists. The idealists said Washington should stop backing dictators. They believed America could and should pursue its national interests and freedom and democracy around the world. The realists would respond that foreign policy had to be clear-headed and cold-hearted. Morality was a nice add-on, but only when convenient. Well, now there is an idealist in the White House. He's exporting democracy and has put a tyrant on trial. Yet a majority of Americans, idealists and realists, are howling in dismay. This hour, On Point, is realism making a comeback? With Washington beginning to set a timetable for getting out of Iraq, are the pragmatists back in charge? In a moment, we'll talk to two foreign policy thinkers who are calling for new realism in U.S. foreign policy. But first, new sobering allegations out of Iraq that American forces may have used white phosphorus artillery shells against civilians in Fallujah 1 year ago. Joining us to talk about that from London this morning is Paul Reynolds, World Affairs Correspondent for BBC News Online. Paul, welcome.
Hi, Bob.
Tell us first about the weapon. How does it work?
White phosphorus is an incendiary device. It's basically used for two reasons in warfare. One is to illuminate. It sends out this very bright light, of course, and the other is for camouflage. You can advance behind the smoke. But what's emerged in Fallujah, there was an Italian TV documentary by Rai, the Italian broadcaster, which claimed that white phosphorus had been used as a weapon against civilians. This, I have to say, is largely unproved, but what's come out since then, thanks to some of the blog sites, is that U.S. soldiers and Marines have been using white phosphorus against military targets in order to try to get enemy combatants out of cover so that they can be killed in the open.
In other words, it's used to drive them out of bunkers or buildings or whatever?
Exactly. They even have a phrase for it. It's called shake and bake.
What does that mean?
Well, shake and bake, you'll understand. I lived in New York for 4 years, and we had children there, so we knew about shaking and baking a piece of chicken and seasoning in a bag and then baking it. And this is it's an American phrase which I've had to explain over here. And basically, it's the soldiers and the Marines saying, this is a shake and bake. You throw this white stuff, the phosphorus, at them, and that shakes it around, and I guess the bake comes from the burning. And then they're also killed with high explosive charges. It's not a pretty subject, but it's been written about in a magazine called Field Artillery, which the U.S. Army produces. And the soldiers, and I've had several emails from former soldiers saying, yes, this is what we do.
Explain the significance of the disclosure that U.S. troops may have used white phosphorus as a lethal weapon.
Well, the soldiers say it's not at all significant, and of course U.S. supporters here say, you know, there's a lot of fuss about nothing. But the opponents are saying that comes close to being a chemical weapon. Some of them say it is a chemical weapon, which would be banned under the Chemical Weapons Convention, which the U.S. is a signatory to. The U.S. has not signed up to another convention which covers incendiaries. Protocol 3 of this convention says that incendiaries can't be used against civilians or against military targets in clearly civilian areas. The U.S. is not signed up to that, but the U.S. does restrict its use and made a bad public relations error here by denying that it had been used as a weapon. The U.S. ambassador in London, new ambassador, underbriefed Mr. Robert Holmes Tuttle. His father, I think, must have been the Holmes Tuttle who supported Ronald Reagan once. He actually denied it was being used as a weapon and had to withdraw that. So it's become a bit of the political infighting, Bob, among the newspapers and media groups which have opposed the war in Iraq.
What about in Iraq? Has it become a controversial among the civilian and or the political population?
Well, I think the Iraqi government has sent a so-called investigation commission to Fallujah, but that sounds pretty pro forma to me. I don't suppose they'll get very far because this is a country in such anarchy. I think that people will probably shrug their shoulders and think, well, this is just another part of the very, very serious and violent situation there.
And as you pointed out, it is gaining some international notoriety, though. And I noticed that Britain was quick to admit its use by British troops in Iraq, but also quick to point out that it was not used as a weapon.
Well, the British are saying that they use white phosphorus as a I say, for illumination and camouflage purposes. And this was the position the Pentagon took, and the State Department had a website saying this. That's had to be withdrawn. And if they hadn't denied it in the first place, this probably wouldn't have been such a big story. But once you make a false denial, that gives your opponent something to get hold of. That's what happened.
What's likely to happen next?
Well, I don't think much is going to happen next. I mean, some people here are calling it for it to be reclassified as a chemical weapon. In technical terms, I suppose you could say that some people say, well, it's a chemical weapon because it's got toxic properties, and the US and Britain say it's not a chemical weapon because it's got thermal properties and therefore doesn't come under the convention. I suppose this will go away, really, when the next controversy comes up.
Paul Reynolds, thank you very much. Paul Reynolds is World Affairs Correspondent for the BBC News Online. Every new report, such as this one, raises the question once again about whether any war can be fought cleanly. There was also news this week that the Senate has voted to force the Bush administration to start the clock on withdrawing from Iraq. This hour, we're talking about how these developments fit into the larger strategic doctrine for U.S. foreign policy. You can join the conversation. Are you of the realist persuasion? Or do you think ideals should drive this country's policies? And can you have it both ways? Join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us from New York City is Richard Haas, President of the Council on Foreign Relations, also the author of The Opportunity, America's Moment to Alter History's Course. Welcome, Dr. Haas.
Thanks very much.
Also joining us from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty, Senior Editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hi, Jack.
Hello, Bob. Hello, Mr. Haas.
And in a few minutes, we'll be joined by Andrew Basevich, Professor of International Relations at Boston University, who recently wrote a column in the Boston Globe calling for what he calls a realist foreign policy. But first to you, Dr. Haas, let me ask you, you also wrote a column recently. It ran in the New York Times and was titled, Is There a Doctrine in the House? Lay out your basic argument for why this country needs a realist foreign policy and why you think we don't have one right now.
Well, I'd say first and foremost, we need a foreign policy doctrine. It's too hard to navigate the day-in, day-out challenges of running a global foreign policy without one. And now it's been roughly two decades since the United States had containment, which got us through the Cold War, but obviously it became largely irrelevant once the Cold War was won. In my view, we need a foreign policy doctrine that allows the United States to deal with what are the defining issues of this era. It is not a rising China. It is not Japan or Europe or anything else. What are the defining challenges of this era are the various forms of globalization, for example, the spread of nuclear weapons or al-Qaeda and other forms of terrorism or global climate change or pandemic flu and HIV/AIDS and so forth. These are all global issues. And what I'm suggesting is the United States needs an approach to foreign policy where we essentially bring in the other major powers to work with us against these common problems, hence the word integration. We integrate them into the effort. We then try to organize the world so we can better deal with these challenges. We've done it, for example, against terrorism. We've done it in the area of trade. My argument is we need to integrate the world to deal with these other global challenges. Thirdly, I'd like to bring in the poor people of the world, the one out of every three people on this planet, who are subsisting on $2 a day or less. And lastly, this gives us a basis for trying to integrate or bring in the pariahs, the North Koreas, the Irans, essentially to say, if you begin to play the international game by rules that the rest of us accept, then certain incentives will come your way. So what I've tried to do is provide a foreign policy framework that I believe addresses the fundamental challenges of this era, and it's also consistent with the reality that the United States cannot meet these challenges by itself, given their nature, but also given the limits to American resources.
Because we're overextended and overspent.
We are seriously overextended and overspent. But even beyond that, it's simply the nature of these challenges that no single country, no matter how powerful, can deal with them successfully by itself, and there's really nothing in the world that we can do better by ourselves than we couldn't do with others.
Put it in the context, if you would, of current Bush policy, which the so-called Bush Doctrine, which you say is not so much a coherent policy as a mix of tactics.
Right. Well, I think what we've seen over the last 5 years, and particularly in the first term, are different impulses. But there's been an awful lot of unilateralism. The war in Iraq was largely a unilateral undertaking. There's also at times been a tremendous emphasis on counterterrorism, which I think is a necessary dimension of American foreign policy, but could hardly be the whole of it. There's also been a large emphasis on democracy promotion, which gets to the core of some of the questions you're obviously raising here on the show, which I would suggest, again, is one legitimate element of American foreign policy. But we simply don't have the luxury of making it the centerpiece of American foreign policy, given the fact that we need to work with an awful lot of non-democracies if we're going to succeed in meeting these global challenges. For example, we need China's help in dealing, say, with the North Korean nuclear challenge, or we need Russia's help in dealing with the Iranian challenge. And also, as we've learned in Iraq and elsewhere, trying to foster democracy around the world is easier said than done. So again, it's neither, I think, desirable nor practical to make it the centerpiece of what the United States does in the world.
So then you see integration as a new pragmatic way to adapt to the new reality.
Exactly right. And this is, let me just add that I believe this is pretty hard-headed stuff, so don't get me wrong. Yeah, you did not invite Rodney King as your guest here today, and this is not a why can't we all get along foreign policy, but this is simply a pragmatic, necessary response to the fact that, again, the real challenges of this year are ones that we've got to work with others to meet.
On Point listeners, a reminder, you can join the conversation. Where are we now from your point of view? How would you run this country's foreign policy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking today with Richard Haas, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and with On Point news analyst Jack Beatty about a possible new direction for America's foreign policy. A reminder that you can join the conversation. Do you like the Bush Doctrine? Are times changing in Washington foreign policy circles? Jack Beatty, let me ask you, do you think that George Bush is hearing what a lot of foreign policy experts are also hearing and taking it in?
Well, he may not be hearing the experts, but I think he's hearing the reality that we there are limits to what we can accomplish, and we're learning that by the second in Iraq. Our goals and our means are disjunct. We have an insolvent foreign policy, to use a phrase that Walter Lippmann used. But, you know, toward Mr. Haas's idea of integration, the neoconservatives, who really ran foreign policy for a good while in the Bush administration, make three criticisms. One is that integration with other nations too closely limits our freedom of action, that we're at the mercy then of these alliances. Second, they say, well, integration, fine, but toward what end? What are the goals of this thing? What's the vision? And third, they say, well, democracy promotion isn't just a sort of laudable goal. It's practical politics. Unless there's democracy in Iraq, in Saudi Arabia, in the Middle East, we're going to have more terrorism.
To your first point, Jack, the neos might say the last thing the U.S. wants is to become subservient to the interests of other nations.
Well, that's right. And that was put as they criticized John Kerry. They said, he wants to get a permission slip every time the U.S. Wants to act abroad. We can't do that.
Okay. Joining us now in the studio is Andrew Basevich, professor of international relations at Boston University and author of The New American Militarism, How Americans Are Seduced by War. Dr. Basevich, hello, and thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks very much.
Help us, if you would, first understand the history of the debate over realist versus moral foreign policy in this country.
Well, let me see if I can do about a 35-second tutorial trying to distinguish between realists or you used the word moralists. I would probably call them idealists. Realists like to imagine, at least, that they see the world as it really is and believe that our capacity, any nation's capacity, to change the world is quite limited. They see international politics as a competition for power, and they believe that all nations, both the good guys and the bad guys, are motivated primarily out of self-interest. In contrast, idealists really see the world as it ought to be rather than as it is. They believe that the international order is very malleable, all people are basically alike, that they share common aspirations, and that somehow men of goodwill ought to be able to solve the world's problems. I mean, the bottom line is, I think that idealists believe in the possibility of lasting world peace. Realists would argue that we're going to have to settle for something short of that.
So a realist would recognize that there's little that can be done to change the nature of international politics?
Right, which, of course, does not mean that a realist is necessarily an isolationist who turns his back on the world or counsels inaction. But a realist approaches the world, I think, with some modesty about what we can possibly change. You know, I believe Dr. Haas would see himself as a realist. I know I call myself a realist. I think the difference, one of the differences between us really is captured by that column of his that you referenced, where he's proposing a new doctrine. And kind of the school that I come from would suggest that the likelihood of being able to devise a one-size-fits-all doctrine is just not very great. That even the notion that for the several decades after 1945 that the United States adhered to a doctrine of containment is a vast oversimplification. I mean, if you look at the greater Middle East, which is the part of the world that we're most interested in, and look at U.S. policies in the greater Middle East from 1945 until the end of the Cold War, containment does not adequately describe our actual behavior. So I'm wary of one-size-fit-all doctrines, and although I certainly favor the pragmatism that he calls for.
Richard Haas, weigh in here. In your view, is one-size-fits-all the right way to describe this?
If you describe it that way, maybe not. But what you do need as a policymaker, I would suggest, is an initial approach to things. If you don't have a doctrine, if you don't have an intellectual construct, you have no yardstick or mechanism by which to say how much and what kind of military forces do we need, or where should we focus our intelligence, or what kind of foreign assistance programs do we want, or a certain challenge comes into your inbox one day and you don't have an approach to take. What I'm suggesting is not that this necessarily answers every question. It's not a straitjacket any more than containment was a straitjacket. But it does give you a philosophy. It gives you a way to explain yourself to your own people. It gives you a way to explain yourself to your allies. It gives you a way to warn your real or potential foes in the world. So I find it extraordinarily useful, and I believe the United States pays an enormous price when it doesn't have this sort of an intellectual foundation for its foreign policy.
I think the difference between us might be that what I would have, and I certainly agree that we can't just simply make it up as we go along, but that what we need is not a doctrine. Again, I'm very skeptical of that, but in a sense a point of view, a temperament that helps us prioritize our interests, that helps us approach addressing those interests with an element of realism. I mean, I'll cite a sentence from Dr. Haas's New York Times column to try to illustrate what I mean. He wrote, "The United States," he's advocating this, "the United States would forge partnerships with China and Russia, accept India's nuclear status, and welcome a more assertive Japan under the doctrine of integration." Well, I mean, in a sense, one would say all that's wonderful, but there are profound internal contradictions in that sentence. I mean, a partnership with China is at odds with the notion of a militarily strong India. A partnership with China is not something that is consistent with welcoming a more assertive Japan. So again, I'm just the notion that by attaching this label integration to U.S. policy that we can get the lions to lie down with the lambs is something that I'm very wary of.
Dr. Haas, how do you avoid those international policy conflicts?
Well, you can't avoid altogether trade-offs and tensions, but let me suggest that we're doing exactly what I'm suggesting. The United States has the strongest relationship it's had with Japan at a time Japan is becoming more assertive. The United States does have a good relationship with India, and there's no necessary tension between a good relationship with India and a productive relationship with China. Indeed, I would argue they're reinforcing. The United States is cooperating with China, say, on the North Korean nuclear challenge. So again, I see no existential or fundamental impossibilities of pursuing exactly the sort of approach that I'm advocating. Indeed, what's so interesting to me is even though the administration does not use the nomenclature I'm suggesting, words like integration, this is increasingly what the United States is either doing or trying to do, and it's essentially reality-driven. It's being driven by the threats that the United States faces and the fact that we can't meet these threats on our own.
Jack Beatty, would you like to weigh in here?
Yeah, I wanted to get Richard Haass to comment on my earlier critique, and I'll add one. I mean, again, the neoconservatives look at containment, and they say, yes, that worked, but, you know, containment allows states to keep their internal systems as they are. It's a policy of the status quo. It says you can't go beyond your current borders, but you can do whatever you want within them. And they take that policy as a status of the status quo, and they would criticism of it, and they would apply it to your idea and also with the three ones I mentioned earlier, the three critiques, that right. Integration limits our freedom of action and we don't know what the goal of integration is, and that democracy promotion itself is a very practical sort of realistic goal.
Well, let me quickly then address them all. Containment had two dimensions. One was to stop the spread of Soviet power and communism, but containment under Kennan's original writing also suggested that it would bring about the internal mellowing of Soviet power. And it took 4 or 5 decades, and he was right. What I'm suggesting is that the emphasis should be on the foreign policy of other countries. I'm not saying we should ignore what goes on inside them. It's simply a question of emphasis. It's possible that my approach would to some extent limit our freedom of action, but on balance, it's got to be worth it. And if we want others to participate with us, if we want them to share the burdens, if we want them to join us in fighting terrorism or in stopping the spread of nuclear weapons, we may have to accept some constraints. I'm simply saying that on balance, I believe limited constraints would be worth it if we get significant participation by others. The ends of what I'm suggesting, I would think, are clear. I want to live in a world where nuclear weapons do not proliferate. I want to live in a world in which terrorists do not have the freedom to operate. I want to live in a world in which trade and investment grow, in which we do something to arrest or slow global climate change, in which we do something to deal with diseases, in which genocide is not commonplace. I would think that these ends are perfectly clear, and I would say ambitious enough. So I could be criticized for many things, but not having goals, I would think, is not one of them. Democracy can be part of what it is we do here. Again, my only point is that in and of itself, democracy does not address most of the challenges that are on our agenda today. It's awfully hard to foster or bring about. And on occasion, we simply don't have the luxury of making democracy promotion our priority, given the fact that we have some life-threatening dangers we've got to deal with.
Richard Haass, Andrew Bacevich is almost straining at the microphone.
Not at all. But I want to live in the same world that Richard Haass wants to live in. But I'm not sure that Osama bin Laden wants to live in that world. I'm not sure that other Islamic radicals want to live in that world. I'm not sure that Pervez Musharraf really wants to live in that world. So the notion that a strategy, a doctrine of integration can put us on a glide path to that world seems to me to just set aside or overlook a host of complications. I mean, Dr. Haass said that properly. Cited areas where, for example, we are cooperating with the People's Republic of China, for example, North Korea. Why? Because we both have a common interest in trying to prevent North Korea from going nuclear. But that doesn't mean that we're on our way to forging a partnership with the People's Republic of China. We have great differences on other matters, to cite Taiwan as merely one example.
Let's bring on point listeners to the conversation now. Listeners, does America have a coherent foreign policy that you understand right now? The number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Dana is joining us from Indian Head, Maryland. Hi, Dana.
Hi, how you doing? I have several points. Hopefully I can get them in quickly enough for your time period. we do not have the kind of policies that are able to be propagated around the world. I mean, we have to go back and look at the Soviet era. In the Soviet era, we outspent the Russians. We put a cruise missile on every submarine, and if we didn't have them there, we made it so that they thought that we did, and we made their military complex spend themselves into oblivion. And that was a containment policy, but it was also a way of attacking their infrastructure, and then they crumbled under it. When we went into Iraq, we fought a war that we didn't pay attention to either the history of how these wars are fought or the fact that we have advantages. The advantage of the U.S. military is that no one can stand to the front of us and be able to fight and win. They get slaughtered. We just slaughter them. We have so much firepower, and I can talk from experience. I've been most of the last 2 years in Iraq, and we never get attacked from the front. And what we need is a policy of containment incursion where we look at the policies of the world and say, okay, well, let's contain, and it worked in Iraq. We contained them. We put no-fly zones in the north. The Kurds built their own government. We put them in the south. They protected the people. Saddam, obviously, his government was crumbling because his infrastructure crumbled. And had we done an incursion where we took our 140,000 troops and pulled them into a border town, disarmed the town, and gave them food, water, and the ability to build their own government and a secure perimeter, and once that was done, if the policies of that country didn't change, we incurred more of their, we went into a further incursion so that we don't have long supply lines that are attacked, and we just show you that the longer that you keep up your policies, the more of your country you will lose control of. There's nothing Saddam Hussein could have done. And now we have the problem of having been there. I mean, I was in an IED attack in December. And we cannot get out of our gates without getting blown up.
Andrew Bacevich, the situation in Iraq, bad military planning, bad foreign policy planning.
Yes, on both counts. I'd like to respond to Dana in this way, if I could. I mean, I understood his comment to be a regret that we abandoned the prior strategy of trying to contain Saddam Hussein. I hope I understood him correctly. And I'd just like to point out the extent to which the containment of Saddam, although well-intentioned by those who conceived it in Washington, actually gave rise to enormous complications, both practical and moral. It was the decision of the elder President Bush to contain Saddam after the limited success of Operation Desert Storm, which left Saddam in power, that caused the United States to create a substantial garrison in Saudi Arabia maintained throughout the 1990s in order to enforce the no-fly zones. And it was the fact that the United States remained in Saudi Arabia after Operation Desert Storm, which, of course, helped to inflame Islamic radical opposition to the United States and in part, at least, set the stage for 9/11. And my point here, again, is that the notion that there are simple solutions, that we can devise a doctrine which will provide a definitive answer to the problems of international politics, strikes me as the very inverse of realism.
You argue, you've written, that we should liquidate our presence there in Iraq.
Yes, I'm on the record as saying that I believe the war is unwinnable, and I probably subscribe to the notion that in many respects the U.S. military presence there is fueling the insurgency, and that the time has come for us to recognize that the insurgency is going to be won or lost, the country is going to stand or fall based on the efforts of the Iraqi people. We've done as much as we can do, and we need to extricate ourselves from that situation.
Richard Haas, we're less than a minute before the break. Do you want to weigh in?
I think that would be a prescription for disaster. I believe the United States has to continue involving itself in Iraq, has to continue supporting a political process as well as Iraqi efforts to become stronger militarily. I think the time will soon come when we can begin, indeed should begin, to draw down American forces, but I do not believe we should pull out altogether. That, to me, again, would be a strategic mistake of the first order.
We'll pick up the conversation from there after the break. We're talking about U.S. foreign policy today on Point. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for On Point comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston. Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Information is available at Bicon.com, B-I-C-O-N.com. And Private Wealth Management at Babson Capital, for more than 60 years helping clients build and preserve wealth through financial planning, investment management, and trust services. In Cambridge and on the web at BabsonCapital.com.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. You can join the conversation. We've been hearing from two foreign policy analysts today, each with their own take on what a new realist foreign policy, American foreign policy, should look like. What do you think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. In the studio with us is Andrew Basevich, professor of international relations at Boston University. We're also joined by Richard Haas, president of the Council on Foreign Relations. And finally, On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, a senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly, is also with us. Mr. Haas, before we went away, you were talking about how you thought it might be a mistake for the U.S. to simply move out of Iraq as quickly as possible. Given the continuing international opposition to our presence there, and your call for integration in which the U.S. is sensitive to the concerns of the international community, how can we afford to stay?
Well, we are where we are where we are. This is not a war I advocated, but again, we are where we are. I would take issue with your question about international opposition. I actually believe it's much less. We now have most of the countries of NATO assisting us in a training effort in Iraq, and we now have signs that even the Arab world is beginning to come behind what the United States is trying to do, which is essentially keep Iraq intact in a way that the three principal demographic groups are willing to coexist. At this point, I simply think this is something that we need to see through, and to the extent we can involve the UN, which we are in the upcoming December elections, we can involve others in training, we can involve others in both political support for the process, for example, creating a regional political structure to deal with the Iraqi situation. I actually think this is increasingly moving from having begun as a largely unilateral undertaking to increasingly one that is consistent with my thinking about integration.
And before we go back to the phones, Professor Basevich, is this realistic from your point of view?
No, it's not realistic from my point of view. Expectation that informed this war, that the United States could transform the greater Middle East, that the United States could rather handily create a liberal, democratic Iraq, strikes me as the height of unrealism. And it seems to me that most of the events that we've seen unfolding in the past couple of years have confirmed that. That's not to suggest that no good or no progress has been made on the political front. Certainly there has been. But the costs to the United States have been exorbitant. And I'm pretty much persuaded by the argument that what we really have done as a result of this misguided war is to enhance Osama bin Laden's ability to recruit people to attack us.
To the phones, 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Michael joins us from Boston, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on Point.
Yes, speaking as one who would like to have a cool head ruling a warm heart in our policy, I'd like to point out that hypocrisy or the appearance of hypocrisy is very dangerous in a media-saturated world. I would say that, as far as I can tell, we don't really have an idealist foreign policy. We have a misguidedly realist foreign policy based on an unrealistic view of the world, which is cloaked with idealism largely in the person of President Bush, who I believe is probably quite sincere, but I believe is the front for, you know, not in any grand conspiratorial way, this is all out in the open, for a lot of people who really believe that they're acting in the best interests of the U.S. and the U.S. alone, and you know, it's very hard to convince me that Dick Cheney really cares a jot about what happens to Iraqis.
Richard Haas, your take on that?
Well, I think the call is on to something here. The administration has articulated an incredibly muscular or robust approach to promoting democracy. If they act on it everywhere, I think it gets us into trouble. It could lead to the sorts of situations we had in Iraq, but also, again, it's inconsistent with the fact that we've got to work with a lot of non-democracies in dealing with global challenges. On the other hand, if they don't act on it, then it opens them up to the charge that there's a tremendous gap between American rhetoric and American policy. And that's the charge, for example, that people are making when it comes, say, to the states of the former Soviet Union, where the United States is increasingly in bed with a bunch of countries that are anything but democratic in the name of counterterrorism. It's for that reason that I was and remain quite skeptical of this heavy rhetorical emphasis like we saw in the second inaugural speech of the president on promoting democracy. I simply don't think it's a sustainable foreign policy for the United States.
Jack Beatty, George Bush came into office arguing and campaigned arguing that the United States should not be the world's policeman, and arguably that's what we are right now.
Well, we're trying to be and not doing such a good job of it. You know, Michael raised a very interesting question there, and that is that underneath this rhetoric, what is our real policy and what's driving it? You know, Colonel Wilkerson, known to Mr. Haas, former chief aide to Colin Powell, recently said that, you know, what was driving the foreign policy was a cabal, he called it, from the vice president's office and the Pentagon. That basically seized control of policy, and the president could say whatever he wanted. But these people were running it. What was their goal? Well, Cheney, you know, has said, you know, we need to go on the dark side, he mentioned at one point early on. And some people have attributed to him the Hobbesian view that what we need to do is basically kill a lot of people, bloody a lot of people in the Arab world. That will give them, you know, that'll show them not to mess with us. And that's the sort of primitive instinct going on here behind, you know, the real driving force behind it is in front of it is this screen of we want to save Iraq and create democracy and so on, but that the real motive is just a bang.
Professor Bacevich.
Well, as somebody who sees himself as a realist but is also an American, I mean, I would argue emphatically that any sustainable U.S. foreign policy has to take moral considerations into account. We will not be able to have an amoral policy for a long period of time. So we have to permit moral considerations into the conversation. I think one of my problems with the Bush administration is that morality, the moral consideration revolves around our obligation to do something to them, to change them. My vote would be to widen the conversation about the moral dimension of foreign policy by asking what morality really means, and perhaps by trying to get Americans to contemplate the moral aspect of our way of life, which at the end of the day is the true motive force for our behavior in the world. It's a cheap shot to say that this is a war for oil. It's not a cheap shot to say that the United States would not have wandered into this labyrinth of the Middle East had we not persuaded ourselves that cheap oil was essential to the American way of life. And that conviction has led us into one heck of a morass, it seems to me.
Richard Haas, does the wallet lead our noses, our foreign policy noses around the world? Are we more concerned about what happens to us personally when it comes to our own economy and our own comfort level with living every day than we are with the sensibilities of other nations?
To a much less extent than people believe. The Marxists used to say that capitalists and American foreign policy was largely driven by economic concerns. And if that was the case, we never would have done what we did in Vietnam. I actually think Iraq was not driven by economic concerns, except only in the indirect sense that Dr. Bacevich points out, that obviously that part of the world is so critical because of energy. But I actually believe that my former colleagues were largely motivated not by concerns about energy, but by a much more ideological belief that a quick and easy triumph in Iraq, which is what they fully expected, would be a transforming event, not simply for Iraq, but for the region and indeed the world, that after 9/11, that this would be the sort of thing that would shift the momentum in international relations. I questioned it at the time, and clearly I think history has shown that they were far too optimistic about the benefits, and they clearly dramatically underestimated the potential and what have turned out to be the actual costs.
Let's take another call. Michael, you're on with us from Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Oh, thank you. I'm absolutely delighted that you're having this show and reexamining the foundations and thinking of American foreign policy. My congratulations to you and all your guests. My own commentary is several. One is we have to be very careful with language. Jack Beatty, I heard you repeat the very common used phrase, neoconservatives. But then you later also said correctly, this is a cabal in the White House. They're not neoconservative at all. That's a label they put to themselves or the press. I call them radical reactionaries and incompetent imperialists. Secondly, I would like to argue that there is certain realism in idealism, and that to try to separate these two, as the show is the premise, is a mistake. We need a realistic foreign policy based on the basic American values and ideals that has driven the better half of our nation over many years. So a third point about language is we keep talking about national security. Well, national security is an outdated oxymoron. There is no such thing as national security. We see that in everything from military to terrorism to Asian flu to avian flu. Everything travels at the speed of the internet, or at least of airliners. Finally, it's not that I'm against democracy or American foreign policy pushing it, but let's go to the foundations. We need a foreign policy based on respect for all, on development for all, economic development for all, and self-determination for all, which leads hope in the future for hope for all, and ultimately maybe democracy. And I'm tired of living in a world where I can't pass on to my children and grandchildren any hope for a more peaceful world. Every time we build our foreign policy on militarism and more weapons, and by the way, we talk about non-proliferation of nuclear weapons, this country will never stop proliferation of nuclear weapons until we're willing to give them up ourselves.
Michael, thank you very much. As we come to the end of the show here, Andrew Bacevich, in a way, you're both talking about this, both you and Mr. Haas, from your own point of view, allowing the peoples of the world, so to speak, to live their own lives peacefully with the U.S.
Well, I'm not sure that we're on the same wavelength there. I mean,
The bottom line is the same.
Yeah, I suppose the bottom line is the same. But I mean, when the caller talks about a foreign policy that's based on our sort of founding ideals or the better part of our American nature, it seems to me that part of the problem is that there is a great conflict at the core of what it is to be an American. I mean, the founders. Even in the colonial era, there was this profound conviction that somehow the United States had some kind of providential responsibility to the rest of the world. And that has given rise to a couple of ideas about how to fulfill that responsibility. One of those is that the United States has an obligation to change the world. I mean, the subtitle of Dr. Haas's new book, The Opportunities, is America's Moment to Alter History's Course. I myself don't believe that it is within our power to alter history's course.
Dr. Haas, last comment.
I do believe it's in our power to alter history's course, and the fundamental reason is we are at an extraordinarily rare and special moment of history where, unlike the last 350 years, the prospects for great power conflict are remote. And my aim in writing this book and talking about integration is to basically say the United States has a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to lock this in for decades to come. And that would liberate us to focus our energies and our limited resources on what I think are the real challenges of this era, which are not other major powers, but instead what you might call the dark side of globalization. And
Richard,
that's what I believe American Richard, foreign policy should focus on.
Richard Haas, President of the Council on Foreign Relations, thank you. Also, Andrew Bacevich, Professor at Boston University. On Point News Analyst Jack Beatty, thanks. We end the hour now with a commentary you wrote on the argument being made for troop withdrawal from Iraq.
When a former Assistant Secretary of Defense in the Reagan Pentagon calls for 80,000 U.S. troops to be withdrawn from Iraq in 2006 and the remaining 60,000 in 2007, a Congress belatedly stirring on the war takes notice. In a paper for the Center for American Progress, Lawrence Korb, a frequent guest on this program, argues that Iraq has diverted resources from the campaign against al-Qaeda. Quote, global terrorist attacks classified as significant by the State Department have tripled under President Bush's watch, end quote. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, more U.S. troops have been killed this year, 62, than in any year since our invasion in 2001, and there is a recrudescence of Taliban and al-Qaeda terrorism. Korb would redeploy 20,000 troops from Iraq to Afghanistan, station others in Kuwait and on ships in the Persian Gulf, dispatch 2,000 to terrorist hotspots in the Philippines and the Horn of Africa, and return all guard and reserve forces to the U.S. for homeland defense. A year from now, if 140,000 ground troops are still in Iraq, Korb says, quote, we will destroy the all-volunteer army, end quote. With units facing a third tour of duty, young officers will resign, recruitment will freeze, morale collapse, performance deteriorate. While we sent the army to save Iraq, we now have to redeploy the army to save the army. Korb writes, our presence has created new alliances between old enemies, Islamist extremist and Sunni nationalist, and it has neither made us Iraqi friends nor made Iraq safer. A recent U.S. government survey of Iraqi opinion found that half support insurgent attacks on U.S. troops, and a majority feel less safe when U.S. troops patrol their neighborhoods. To those who say we can't withdraw until we have trained Iraqi forces to American standards, Korb says our being there saps the Iraqi will to fight. Next month, Iraq will hold parliamentary elections, the start of a political solution to the insurgency. American blood and treasure have won a new beginning for Iraq. In the final analysis, President Kennedy said in his last public interview on Vietnam, it's their war and their country. What he said of the South Vietnamese then applies to the Iraqis now. We have a war of our own to fight against an enemy we aid with every bomb we drop in Iraq, every prisoner we torture, every lie we tell to disguise what retired General William Odom calls the worst strategic blunder in American history.
Jack Beatty is On Point News analyst and senior editor at The Atlantic Monthly. I'm Bob Oakes, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.